You're listening to the Writers Forum. I'm your host, Mike Tusa, and today I'll be speaking with author Richard Bailey about his new book, Pirate's Cove, an insider's account of the infamous Southport Lane scandal. Richard is a specialist in corporate development, and this is, I think, his first book. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Well, thank you, Michael. Yes, you're right. It is my first book.
Good. So tell us then, how is it that you came to write the book?
Well, you know, I've spent about 35 years kind of parachuting into companies that are in distress and, you know, restructuring them or, you know, just basically putting the right systems and structures in place so that they can succeed. I mean, they're not always in distress. And I was hired by this company, this private equity firm that came out of nowhere in 2013, because they were originally going to make an investment in a pharmaceutical company in northern New Jersey. And this private equity firm was headquartered in New York. And so I went there. They hired me to go there and just kind of assess the place. I went back to the private equity company and, you know, sat in their big fancy conference room in Midtown Manhattan. And the 26-year-old self-proclaimed financial prodigy who was the founder and CEO of the private equity firm, looked at me and said, you know, so should I, you know, buy this company? And I said, no. And he goes, he just stared at me kind of strangely. And he goes, why not? I said, because you're going to lose all your money. I said, you know, A, this isn't, you know, this company isn't in that much trouble. B, it's family owned. You've got a guy that's the CEO and his two daughters and, you know, their best friend is the CFO. And I said, you know, so every time they have a birthday party, every holiday, you know, every bar mitzvah or whatever, they're going to have a board meeting and you're not going to be there. And I said, so, and they already have one sugar daddy. Why don't they need a second one? So he looked at me, you know, and thought, wow, people don't usually tell me that, you know, people usually say, oh yeah, let's go, let's invest. So that's how I met those guys. They then called me about 3 weeks later and asked me if I wanted to take a look at the vineyard that they had purchased out on Eastern Long Island, called Lieb Vineyards. And I'm like, you know, I've dealt mostly in steel and semiconductor companies. And I was like, I don't know anything about vineyards. I mean, I like to drink wine, you know, that doesn't make me, you know, a vineyard manager or CEO. And, you know, so I went out there, I took a look at it. I was like, and, you know, they made it worth my while. The pay was great. And so I said yes. And after about 3 weeks there, just there are so many strange events that were going on, money movements, money was sloshing around all over the place. And I'm like, so they're going, why are they moving in, you know, $500,000 today? And it goes out to somebody else the next day. And, you know, they were basically committing all the overt signs that you would think of somebody who's money laundering. Mm-hmm. So I began to get suspicious, but I kept my mouth, you know, I mean, I like the pay and I kept my mouth shut. So, but after a while, it turns out that, you know, I investigated more and I took me a couple years and I found that they were, as far as I could tell at the very beginning, that they had committed about a $35 million fraud on these insurance companies they said they owned. Turns out in the end, I was only 10%. It was a $350 million fraud. So I wound up, you know, taking a circuitous route and wound up with the FBI, right. Meeting with the FBI, who then asked me to be what's called a confidential human source. I had a code name, you know, and I was, you know, colloquial known, I was wearing a wire, you know, for meetings and things like that. Just to let the audience know it's not a wire. You know, it can be a pen, it can be a belt buckle, it can be an awful lot of things. And as a result of all that, all the companies shut down except for the vineyard. And, four people pled guilty, including the 26-year-old mastermind, and three went to prison. And the 26-year-old mastermind was supposed to be sentenced. He had been cooperating with the FBI for a number of years after everything was shut down, and he committed suicide about 6 weeks before he was sentenced, because you know, and as a result, that sorry, I just had to turn off my phone. As a result, you know, in the legal system, if you die in the midst of, you know, your criminal proceeding before it's closed, you die an innocent man. The government drops all the charges. Right. So, you know, with tens of millions of dollars missing, he dies an innocent man.
How long after you left, after all this happens, did you say, you know what, I think I'm going to write a book about this?
Well, before Alex Burns committed suicide, I had been thinking about it. It turns out my mother, who was a school teacher, I told her the story, and she just looked at me and just said, write it down. This is a great story. And she's the one who said to me, you know, the definition of a great story is an ordinary schmo, which would be me, you know, being thrown into an extraordinary circumstance and see how they do. And what happens is the essence of a great story. So I started to write it, but I didn't have an ending. But in October, late October 2021, when the FBI called me to tell me that Alex Burns had just committed suicide, I literally said to the, after, you know, we talked about, you know, Alex committing suicide and saying that's the end of the story. You know, I said, well, that's the end of the story. And the FBI agent said, yeah, now you can write your book. You know, so that's basically when I started, the end of October 2021. I started doing it in chapters and, you know, putting them on Substack. Releasing that, I figured that was a way to get people to hold me accountable, because it's very easy to sit at your computer and, you know, write 1,000 words and think you're an author and or starting a book, and you never get past 1,000 words. But I did that, and people started subscribing, and then I had to take a couple of weeks off, like 4 weeks off from releasing on Substack, because I had to kind of go through with the FBI what I could talk about and what I couldn't talk about, right, and things like that. Right. And during that time, people were like, hey,
it's next.
Yeah. Have you stopped? This is, you know, I'm waiting for the next chapter. So that's how it happened. So I wrote the whole thing. I sent it to about 40 publishers. You know, a couple responded, and I signed with Bancroft Press.
So, good. Now, you mentioned Alexander Burns. He's kind of the guy at the center of all this.
He is.
Talk to us, and you've told us he ultimately commits suicide, but talk to us about him. You know, you meet the guy. I mean, what is it about this guy that he's able to do all these various things that he does? I mean, how does he get to take over state-regulated companies?
Well, through fraud. They basically, the insurance companies that they purchased had, you know, in some level of financial distress. So they identified those companies, and then they went and met with their managements. And then they did something which, you know, I just would never have the guts to do. They just created stock certificates on their computers, and they deposited them with a big bank. And they sat there, and the bank said, yep, that's good funds. And then they borrowed against those certificates, and that's how it wound up.
Wow. So what, you were at the Vineyard. Is that Southport? Tell me who Southport is.
Southport Lane was the private equity firm that was originally going to buy the pharmaceutical company in New Jersey. And then it had already purchased the Vineyard. And when I took it over, Southport owned 100% of the Vineyard.
Okay. All right. Now, at some point while you're working there, you learn that some of the folks there, including a friend of yours named Jeff, are getting paid fees off of private equity deals. For those of us that might not otherwise know, is that legal or illegal?
It's not illegal. It's just not the way private equity firms work. You know, the theory about making money, and the reason why private equity guys make so much money, is, you know, they'll make an investment into the company. They'll invest in a company, or they'll acquire a company, but they won't profit from that company. Generally, there's ways that they can take money out of the company, but that's, they generally wait until the company's sold. And if they bought it for 10 million and they sell it for 50 million, you know, they get, and you know, they give the investor back their 10 million plus the preferred rate of return. Let's say that preferred rate of return comes up to 15 million. Then, you know, the private equity firm generally gets like 20% of the 35 million left over that we just talked about. That's how they make their money. but you have to be patient. You have to wait. You have to fix the company. You have to, you know, show you have results. What Burns was doing is he was paying people to bring him deals. All right. And, you know, so that's more of an investment banker mindset, you know, who only cares about the transaction happening. I'm the person they bring in the day after the transaction closes to sit there and, you know, kind of deal with the issues. And the investment bankers are long gone. They're on to their next deal at that point. Right. So when I said to him about the first company that you're going to lose all your money, nobody said that to him before, because the only thing people were doing is they were bringing him deals that so they could collect a fee.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you bring your concern to Alex, right? You said, hey, you know, I'm not sure this is the right way to do this. And maybe to Andrew as well, as I think. And talk about what happens, because my impression is they tried to buy you off or buy your silence.
They did. The Vineyard was in, they wanted to merge. This is kind of getting into the weeds a little bit. They wanted to merge the Vineyard into a public company, and so they could, you know, essentially inflate the value of the stock and therefore inflate the value of their ownership. Mm-hmm. So we were going through an audit. You have to be an audited company to be a public company. And I was asking for bank accounts and things like that. So I finally, you know, this is beginning of August 2013. They send me one of the lawyers there at Southport. They had two lawyers working for them too, by the way, in-house lawyers. So none of this shit should ever have happened. but they sat there and, you know, they sent me the bank statements, and all of a sudden I'm seeing money. Now I have a record of the money that's coming in and where it's going out the side. So I sat down with Burns and I said, Alex, this doesn't look good. How am I going to explain this to the auditors? And that's when Andrew came in the room, Andrew Scheer, who is the CFO. And, you know, that is when they sat there and all of a sudden they started, you know, as I say in the book, the praise and the raise.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, to my, you know, chagrin looking back, I took it, you know.
did you realize at the time that that's what they were doing? Okay, I think they're buying my silence.
Kind of. You know, at that point, I didn't have real knowledge of a fraud. I had suspicions, mm-hmm. I've been around for a while. I've seen lots of fraud, and I've seen people, you know, work their way out of it. And I've seen people, you know, pay it all back and nobody finds out. But I've heard so many times the phrase from these guys that are doing this stuff, no one will ever know.
Right.
You know? No one will know that we did this. No one's going to find out. Nobody cares. And so I started hearing that a lot when I started asking about these kind of mysterious money transfers.
Did you, and at some point, did you conclude they were doing money laundering?
I did. Yeah.
Okay.
I did. I sat there and found a filing at the SEC, which, you know, you got to be a little bit of a, you know, securities nerd to go and dig deep into those filings, which said where some of the money was, where the money came from and what it was promised to do. Now, they didn't live up to any of those promises. And so at that point, you have, you know, you've got securities fraud.
Right. All right. You make these discoveries, and I know people reading the book are going to wonder about this too, but you stay with the company. Why?
The honest answer is, the paycheck was really good. Also, in the end of January 2014, Alex Burns just disappeared. He just walked out. He was actually in a meeting with me, and I was asking him. I said, "We're going to need about $250,000 to $500,000 to get through the winter because the Vineyard is a seasonal business, and you know the expenses were bloated, and you know he wasn't willing to cut anything because he was convinced this is going to be, you know, the next thing since, you know, it's going to be better, bigger and better than Gallo Wines." I mean, you know, he had bought his own bullshit. And, you know, so I sat there and I was sitting there and I said, "Alex, we're going to need it." And all of a sudden he looked at me and he goes, you know, "Oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck."
Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. That's the one word you cannot say on the radio.
Okay. He said,
right,
"Oh, shit.
Hold on. Let's do 10 seconds of silence so they can come back and correct that. Okay."
Mm-hmm.
Just pick up from where you were. I'll have Dell erase it.
Okay, thank you. And, you know, he's looking at his phone the whole time. Then all of a sudden he gets, you know, terribly distracted and angry and upset. And I looked at him and I said, you know, what's wrong, kid? Because, you know, he's 26 years old. At that point, I have a son who's 19. I mean, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I was in my mid-50s at that point, you know, so I'm kind of looking at it going, well, you know, what's wrong, kid? And he said, I hate my insurance companies. And he got up out of the conference room, walked out the door, and nobody ever saw him again.
Now, as I understand it, he checked himself into Bellevue, right?
He did. He checked himself in for one day.
One day. Okay.
One day.
For folks that may not know, what is Bellevue?
Okay. So if you know, not from the New York metropolitan area, didn't grow up around there, Bellevue is a big hospital on the east side of Manhattan, but it's really known for its psychiatric ward. And the word Bellevue, you know, kind of in the locals' mind and in the people who live in the tri-state area, you say he's in Bellevue, then, you know, you would figure that he's got a psychiatric issue.
All right.
So he went there for one day.
And then did he transfer his ownership of everything to Andrew or
everything? He just and he signed a document. I'm actually named in this document. I've never seen the whole document, but I saw the parts that had my name in it. I'm actually named in the document. So he signed over all his ownership in all the Southport entities, of which, by the way, they had created almost 100 entities at that point.
Wow.
All right. And most of them were just pass-throughs, shell corporations and things like that. He transferred everything to Andrew with a trade-off, you know, was that they not sue him.
Now, Andrew, look, you knew Andrew as well. I mean, is he as complicit as Alexander, or is he in the dark on all of this?
Andrew was complicit. I worked closely with Andrew for a while. He's a smart guy. He's well educated. He's got a law degree. He's got an MBA from Yale. I mean, you know, he's nobody's dummy. Andrew is the type of guy that, you know, if there was something, he would figure out how to get around the rules. That's really what he excelled at. So that was his value to Alex.
All right. So now at some point you say, you know what, I got to go outside the company and report these findings. Tell us what you did.
Okay. So I originally went to, you know, I'm thinking about it. It took me 6-7 months thinking about it. What do I do? You know, because you've got, you know, like in the cartoons from years ago, you got the good, you know, angel on one shoulder, you got the devil on the old shoulder, and you're arguing with it. You know, there's the whole thing of right and wrong and not wanting to be caught up in this mess. But at the same time, you know, it's a really good paycheck. I kind of like the vineyard life. You know, there's all sorts. It's kind of a mess that you go through. So I'm sitting there and I went to the dump on a Sunday morning here in my town. And one of my neighbors lives about 5 houses up, is an FBI agent, nice guy, just a sweetheart of a guy. And he goes, hey, how you doing? And I just blurted it out. I think I need to talk business with you. And he's like, immediately nice guy goes away. And all of a sudden he's an FBI agent. And he goes, what's wrong? I explained to him. He looks at me. He goes, are you in trouble? I said, no. I said, I got nothing to do with any of this. I just figured it out. And he goes, go home, keep your phone in your hand. Somebody's going to call you in about 10 minutes. And, you know, damn, within 10 minutes, I didn't have a phone call. And so the next day we met with the White Collar Division, with the Boston FBI office in a little diner down here near where I live. And I thought, done. I've done my job. I gave them the evidence. I gave them the hard paper trail. Nothing happened.
They didn't do anything, right?
Yeah. Turns out that they didn't do anything for about 8 months.
It's the Wall Street Journal article that kind of breaks it open, right? Am I reading
It was the Wall Street Journal article, and that came out in like March of 2015. And, you know, and I knew the article was coming out. They didn't contact me, the reporters, but I was told by Southport's in-house counsel, you know, if they call you, do not talk to them. Go back to, you know, send them to me. So I did. And, you know, they did. Well, I never spoke with them ever during the course of the entire thing. And, you know, but they called and I had a lawyer by that point. And the lawyer just says, just give them to me and I'll turn them back over to, you know, the proper people. So I just escaped all that. But at that point, you know, next thing you know, okay, so it's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. You know, I have to go out to the vineyard and confront employees. I mean, you have to remember, you know, the guys from Southport Lane, they hung out at the vineyard a lot, you know. You know, they're drinking, hanging out, and having a good time, you know, during the summer. So I had to go out there and walk them through it. So I did. And I realized that, you know, I had to really move if I was going to keep this place alive. Because, you know, at that point, you start, you know, this is the things that wake you up at night. And it's, you got 43 people working for you. They have families, they have mortgages, they have car payments, they have all that, you know. And the one thing I was the most terrified of doing, and I've had to do it in past life, is telling them that they've lost their job because of all this. So that's really when I decided that it was time. I called a friend of mine. I don't know if it, people down in your area know him. His name is Bo Deedle. He's a very famous detective in New York City. And he's also a pretty well-known actor nowadays. He started in The Irishman and a lot of other things. A good guy. And I've known him for a while. I was introduced to him by a mutual friend. And so I called Bo, and because I wanted someone to tell me that this was a crime. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really what I wanted, because I'm not a lawyer. You know, I'm pretty sure it's a crime, but I'm not in a position of law enforcement or investigations or anything like that. I wanted somebody to tell me, to confirm me, that it was a crime. They did. That's when they introduced me to Michael Weinstein, who was my attorney for the rest of this interesting show. And Michael was a former assistant U.S. attorney down in Washington, D.C. He knew people there. And I hired Michael. And I'll never forget this. As long as I live, I was sitting in my car about to get onto the ferry in Long Island. And Michael's a very calm, smooth. He's a criminal defense attorney. You know, he's used to having, you know, clients in handcuffs and things like that. Another sweetheart of a guy. And he sits there and he just goes, all of a sudden, you know, my phone rings. Hey, Michael. And he doesn't say hello, doesn't he? He just bursts into, oh my God, Richard. He goes, I just talked to the FBI. There's a full task force in Washington run out of Maine Justice, the SEC, the CFTC, you know, the FBI. I just talked to the lead investigator for the FBI, and they want to talk to you. I'm like, okay, I figure I'll just hand them the documents again, and then I'm done with it. But then he asked the question that I never saw coming. And that question was, and they want to know if you'll wear a wire. I said, I'm going to have to think about that.
Okay.
You know, because that was an escalation of this I never intended, never thought that would be happening. You know, never being involved with law enforcement, I figured you hand them proof of the crime, you know, you're done. They go right and prosecute and everything like that. It's not like that. You know, so driving home, I figured, well, now I have to tell my wife what's going on, because, you know, she knew things were bothering me and she knew things, I was tense and everything like that, obviously, as, you know, all spouses do.
Sure. Right.
And I sat there and I was like, okay. I told her. She said, I just want to make sure you know what you're doing. I said, of course I do. I didn't. I had the faintest idea what was coming. And she goes, you know, and I'm not going to, you know, tell you no, because I can see you've already made up your mind to do it. Yeah, I had, you know. Now, you know, there's a part of me that's like, you know, kind of in for the adventure. So I had to sit there and think about it. The you know, and I concluded, and this is what I told the FBI, that these were not the kind of guys that are going to show up, at least I hope, you know, right, not going to show up at my front door with a shotgun.
Right.
You know, these are, you know, they're white collar criminals. They're lawyers. They're accountants. They're very smart guys, very well educated guys. They just step too far over the line and they're getting caught. They're going to get caught. So yeah, that's really how I wound up with the FBI.
All right. And so eventually there's a criminal trial and you are listed as a witness. And I was curious about a witness for the government. Mm-hmm. And you're given a list of admonishments. What is that?
Okay, so that's before the trial.
You know, right?
All right, that's when you're working for the FBI. You know, I agreed to wear a wire and things like that. So they're very, obviously, the FBI, like any, you know, bureau and bureaucracy is in their name, you know. And so they've got their strictures that they have to go through. And one of the things is they have to read you your admonishments. Your admonishments are basically things you cannot do or say as long as you are. And I was a confidential human source.
Okay.
You know, and I had a code name, everything like that. They read my admonishments, but, you know, you don't work for the government. You can't make deals on behalf of the government. If we pay you any money, you have to declare it on your taxes, right, and things like that. So, you know, those, and they have to read you those like every 3 to 6 months. So I got read those a lot.
All right. Well, let's end with this. Okay. You mentioned that Alexander Burns committed suicide, but there's another piece to the story between when he leaves Bellevue and turns over his ownership and before he commits suicide. What happens with Alex during that time period?
Yeah, this is kind of sad. He went down, you know, he went home, he went into rehab in Connecticut for 30 days. And then, you know, about 4 months after, 3 or 4 months after he left Southport, he winds up in Charleston, South Carolina, where he just starts right back in. And, you know, he is got money, you know, I actually talked to some of his friends down there, and I said, how did you meet him? I said, we met him at a card game. And at this point, Alex is probably 28, 29. And they said, you know, what do you do, Alex? And he said, I'm retired. You know, so he held out himself as being this retired financier from New York, who's down in Charleston, South Carolina, living the good life, and meets this nice girl. I've never met her, but, you know, everybody mm-hmm. tells me she was just a lovely girl. And he swindles her. He agrees to send her to pay for her graduate school tuition. But what he did was he went to Discover Bank online and basically stole her identity, got, you know, ran up an $88,000 student loan, paid, you know, $30,000 to Clemson for the tuition, and pocketed the rest himself.
And then did he also commit some kind of pension fraud?
Maybe I misread
that.
Yeah, there's no pension fraud that I was aware of.
Okay.
But, you know,
right.
But the insurance companies that he was stealing with, some of those, you know, I mean, that affects people's pensions.
Sure.
You know.
All right. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. You've been listening to the Writers Forum, and I've been speaking with author Richard Bailey about his new book. It's really interesting, folks. Pirate's Cove, an insider's account of the infamous Southport Lane scandal. Richard, is there a website or a social media site that folks can go to learn more about you, to learn more about the book?
There is. Thank you. The website is, you know, www.rdbailey.com. And my Twitter and Instagram, there's not much on the Instagram about the book. It's generally about, you know, my family and things like that. But that is always, it's Bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y _RDB on both.
All right. Well, Richard, thanks so much for being on the show, man.
Michael, thank you very much.
Folks, the music for the show was provided by Valerie Hunt Jester. It's produced by our very own Del Agnew. Tune in next Tuesday at 4:00 in the afternoon or Wednesday at 5:30 in the morning to hear the next segment of the Writers Forum.